December 12, 2012, in Mayapur. Nectar Devotion, Class 18. Okay, we're going to finish going over Panchanga Bhakti. So devotees, did we say this together? Devotees, deities, dham, hari, nam, bhagavatam. I was thinking maybe we could even do like a little,
I don't know, I have some ideas about maybe how we could make a little person out of it. You know, here's like a, maybe got wings. Maybe that's the eyes from the bhagavatam. Try to think of something so you can remember. Alright, some idea now about Bhagavatam. Now, Shastra in general, but particularly Bhagavatam. So, what's so potent about Bhagavatam?
Ripened fruit,
that's what Prabhupada talks about. Ripened fruit. Like the mango?
This knowledge of Krishna and pastimes.
Knowledge of Krishna is pastimes. How are you going to be attracted to Krishna if you don't know about Krishna, right? Yeah. It's almost destroyed, right? Just by submissively hearing the Bhagavatam. Yeah?
It was written
to help us in
Kali Yuga.
Specifically written to help us in Kali Yuga. It's incredible the philosophy that's in the Bhagavatam, isn't it?
Yes.
Wonderful. But also, I mean, it just refers to Shastra in general, but especially the Bhagavatam that is our main Shastra. Any other thoughts about Bhagavatam?
Transcendental sound vibration.
It's transcendental sound vibration. Chandramouli Swami said one time, when he was reading in the Bhagavatam, he actually heard Prabhupada's voice reading the purport as he was reading. You know, Prabhupada said those purports were his own devotional ecstasies. Okay, so we've got devotees, and we've got dham, and we've got Bhagavatam. Let's do deities. Someone tell me some realization about the deities.
Are they really like the human Prabhupada, or are they like a post box?
Like the post box, your letter actually goes to its destination. Any other? Yes.
Actually, Krishna is exactly there.
Krishna is really exactly there. And of course, there's many stories even in today in our Hare Krishna movement where people experience that the deities are really Krishna, that their deities are not some statue made of brass or marble, but actually there's Krishna there.
One story.
You want to hear a story?
I want to tell.
Oh, you want to tell a story? Oh, good. But you need to talk loudly, maybe stand up.
As from Professor of the lecture, one lady, I think it was in 1972 or 71, and she, before take on some cloth of the deity, she put it on the heater to be warm for deities. And then, by some reasons, she moved to another town. And another lady, who was a new pujari, she had a dream, and deities appeared and tell her, please say thank you that Mataji, I don't remember the name, that I realized this, that warm clothes.
Ah.
And when she got up, she told the story, her president, and he now called her to tell it, thank you from Jesus.
Right, there's no way she would have known that
yes.
Otherwise, yes. So many, many stories like that. I know a devotee who offered tomato chutney, and when she went to take the plate off the altar, all the skins from the tomatoes were all put on the side. Another devotee who, she was late making the offering, when she came, Balaram had walked down a step. And of course I know many devotees who, you know, they see the deities as Krishna. They're not just seeing the deities as the deities. One friend of mine, when she was visiting Mayapur, in walking in procession around Radha Madhava, saw all the pictures come alive.
What?
You know, the pictures, all the pictures behind the deities? You know how we take Prabhupada in procession around the deities?
Yeah.
So she was in the procession in the kirtan. And when they were going in the Guru Pujitan, they were going in the procession, she saw all the pictures were alive.
Sometimes the deities put on weight, like when you... Like a few amount of years, they fed really nicely.
Yes. I was talking to one pujari who said that, there was some big feast they had, like several big feasts in a row, and then none of the clothes of the deities were fit. None. And they had many people check, and like, you know, nothing was fit.
There's this sense in
Sakya
where there is this, they have this procession. They take Garuda on a procession. So they, initially there are four pujaris who carry him out of the temple, and then after you come out of the temple, you meet eight pujaris, and then he goes around, because he grows heavier. And then when, it's like, you know, it goes up to 64 or something like that. It's like, I can't remember the exact number, but it's like this. So they go, like, you know, he grows heavier, and then when they come back to the temple again, you know, it gets lesser. So he goes like this.
Interesting.
No, it's there in Kumbakonam, this temple. It, the procession still happens now.
Oh. Yeah?
Mama Malati tells a story when they first got Jagannath Deities in San Francisco. They were cooking like the first offering for them. And one of the first offerings, like they were really brand new and everything, and they burnt the rice. And so one of the devotees said, oh, well, he doesn't actually eat it, so we just put it on an altar and they offer it to them anyway. So they put it on the altar and they offered it to them. And back then they would just offer things by just chanting Hare Krishna because like, they could tell that at the top of anything else yet. And while they were waiting, like after they put the offering, all of a sudden they heard like the bowl of rice fell to the ground, like it just like splattered everywhere. And so they understood and they're like, yeah, he actually eats.
Yeah. Of course, I'm a very, deity worship is a very practical way to say I'm doing everything for Krishna. It's very practical. When you have deities in your home, you can really, it's not just some, oh, Krishna's the center. But you can really make Krishna the center. You can, you offer your food to the deity. I know of some devotees who, like in a temple, they read all their financial accounts to the deity. I have one friend that any letter that she receives, she reads that to the deity. Any letter she writes, she reads to the deity. So you can really see the deity as the center and the master and the owner of your house. Okay, so we have our little guy there. Devotees, deities, dham. And we, the only one we haven't done is Harinam. So, of course, here in the 64 Angas, we've had some of the chanting has been chanting Krishna's name, Krishna's form, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's pastimes. Some has been japa, some has been chanting with the group. But in general, the holy name, specifically chanting the holy name. So, can you tell me something about the glories of chanting the holy name? I couldn't hear you.
No, this is the first verse of the Shikshastika.
First verse of the Shikshastika, okay.
It's the only way we can obtain in Kali Yuga, the only way.
Okay, so in Kali Yuga there's no other way other than chanting, yes.
You can actually experience ecstasy in kirtan?
Yes. Well, any of these, remember, even a slight attachment for any one of these can arouse ecstasy, even in a
human side.
Something else on Harinam, yes.
Krishna and his names are non-different.
Krishna and his names are non-different. And unlike the deity, to worship the deity, you have to be second initiated, you have to be clean, you have to be trained. And anybody can take the holy name. And Prabhupada said you can take the holy name even in the toilet room. Yes?
I don't remember where I heard this. I was really young. But they say that when you chant Hare Krishna, Krishna is dancing on your tongue.
Oh, Prabhupada said it many times, Krishna is dancing on your tongue. Yes? Yes, very nice.
You can call out to Krishna. You can cry for.
You can really cry to Krishna in the form of his name.
It's
a Yuga Dharma.
The holy name contains all the prayers and glorification scriptures.
All the prayers, all it contains everything, all the potencies, all the prayers, all the everything is contained in the name. So by chanting the name, the whole spiritual world can manifest to you. Yes?
Bhaktivinoda says there are only two alive things in this world, that's Jiva and Harinam.
Jiva and Harinam, yes. Also, sometimes Bhaktivinoda talks about Krishna has two forms, the deity form and the holy name, but of the two, the name is more merciful. Yes?
Cleans the mirror.
Cleans the mirror, yes.
Destroys all the sinful reactions.
Destroys all of our sinful reactions. Very, very nice. Okay. We have now hereby completed the 64 angas of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. So somebody might ask, and I don't know why they would ask, after everything that Rupa Goswami has said, why they would ask this question, but evidently some people would. I said, but Rupa Goswami, maybe Arnashram is also an Anga Bhakti. Again, I don't know why they would ask that. At this point in the Bhakti Goswami to Sindhu, because Rupa Goswami's told us that being perfect in Varnashram is not a qualification for performing bhakti. But maybe you think, although it's not a qualification for performing bhakti, still it's an anga of bhakti. And tomorrow we'll look at two other things that might be angas of bhakti and aren't, renunciation and knowledge. If there's too many back, pass them up. Might be more in the back. Should be enough for everybody to have one. Okay. Now you take this. There's two different ones. They're slightly different. Take this one, pass it down. So you have two slightly different ones. One that this is yoga ladder, one that says yoga ladder in Varnashram. I actually compiled this as part of a seminar that I do on the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. But it's very much in relationship to this point that Rupa Goswami's making. So if we look here at chapter 13, bottom of page 111, some scholars argue that simply by following the principles of Varna and Ashram, one can gradually rise to the perfections achieved by practicing devotional service, but this argument is not accepted by the great authorities. Lord Chaitanya also condemned this idea while he was talking with Ramananda Roy. This advancement of Varna and Ashram is merely external. One should execute the prescribed duties of Varna and Ashram as long as he has not developed spontaneous attachment for hearing about my pastimes and activities. That does not mean you do it until Raganuga Bhakti, because what is the beginning of, what's the beginning qualification for Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is?
Attachment to Krishna.
Attachment to Krishna, some taste. So Mahaprabhu is not talking, or Krishna here, Uddhava is not talking about you have to follow Varnashram until you're at the platform of Bhava or Prema, but you have to follow Varnashram if you haven't yet started Uttam Bhakti. Now we can look at the comparison here on the little charts that I've made up for you here. In other systems of purification, you have to come from Vikarma or sinful activities up through pious activities through Varnashram, and from pious activities you can go then to Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is you're doing the activities of Varnashram for the purpose of personal purification. So in Vikarma, you're doing sinful activities for sense gratification. In Karma Kanda, you're doing pious activities to go to heaven or get heaven on earth. You're doing pious activities to enjoy. Karma Yoga, you're doing pious activities for your own personal purification, to merge to Wicked Brahman. But you can't do pious activities for purification unless you can do pious activities. That makes sense to everybody? In order to do pious activities to merge with the Brahman, you have to first be able to do pious activities to go to heaven. You have to first just know how to do them. So you can't enter into Karma Yoga if you don't first do Karma Kanda. You cannot go from Vikarma to Karma Yoga. You can't. You can't go from being a sinful person, go to Karma Yoga. You have to first go to Karma Kanda. First of all, you won't even, because the desire for liberation won't even come if you just do karma. If you just review karma, yeah.
Why is the result of karma yoga necessarily only emerging in karma?
That is the goal of karma yoga. Not necessarily, but that's generally the goal of karma. What we mean by karma yoga is someone who's doing activities for the personal goal of liberation or salvation. That's their goal. That's their aim. Yes.
And there's also kind of mission of bhakti when we do activities that we're attached to
the
mission.
It's mixed. Yes, karma, mishra, bhakti, karma. Let's get to that. Let's do the main things and we'll get to the next one. So you can go from Varnashram directly to Gyan Yoga. You can go directly from Varnashram either to Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga, which is substantiated in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says that the results of working without fruit of desire and Sankhya Yoga are the same. That the wise say that there's no difference between Sankhya Yoga, which is Jnana, and Karma Yoga. Yes?
I was wondering why you say when people perform Vikarma and they don't desire liberation?
People who are doing Vikarma are desiring to enjoy this world and they're trying to do it in a sinful way. People doing karma are desiring to enjoy this world and they're doing it in a pious way.
Like there are many people, like you meet in the streets, they're doing karma, but they're looking for liberation.
Okay, but they're not probably thinking that their sinful activities are going to give them liberation. I mean, they might think like that, but it won't work. If they're thinking my smoking marijuana is going to give me liberation, it's not going to work. Whatever they may be thinking, it won't achieve that for them. But you cannot go from Vikarma directly to Karma Yoga or directly to Gyan Yoga. You just don't have the qualification to do it. In order to perform Karma Yoga, you have to have piety that sparks the desire for salvation. In order to perform Gyan Yoga, you have to have peace. Krishna says that by renouncing the fruits of your activities, you attain peace. And without that inner peace, you can't perform Gyan Yoga. Gyan Yoga is mostly studying the Shastras, studying the philosophy of the Shastras. Now, Jai Dhritamarj is writing this book, looking at a commentary in a book of the Bible, Ecclesiastes, which is basically a book of Gyan Yoga. It's a book about that everything's useless. It's kind of funny. The author keeps saying, everything's useless, but maybe you should just enjoy the world. But actually, everything's useless. So studying Gyan Yoga is really, it's really one of detachment. You're so interested to merge with the Brahman. So the Karma Yogis, they're offering everything to the Brahman, really, which isn't very satisfying. And I visited a school in London where they offer everything to Paramatma, an elementary school. And the Gyan Yogis, they're just trying to examine through philosophy and through Shastra that everything is useless. That whatever you do here is temporary, nobody really cares, it doesn't stay, it doesn't have any real value, it doesn't have any real meaning. And by the way, we could do that. We could easily have an hour discussion at the end of which you would think, why do I want to do anything? In fact, we could probably do that in 10 minutes if you wanted to try and experiment, but I don't think I want to take the time for that. But it'd be very easy if you just start thinking about it. You know, how short our life is. I talked about this the other day, didn't I? Right? When somebody asked about insignificance. Didn't I talk about that? But then I also talked about how we're significant to Krishna. I didn't just leave it that we're insignificant. So imagine if you just leave it that we're insignificant. Our great-great-grandchildren won't know our name. That's depressing. It is. Great-great-grandchildren, that's not too far from now, you know. I've got a grandson here. That means his grandchildren. Chakra's grandchildren will not know my name. No, they won't. Chances are 99%. I've asked this question of thousands of devotees over the years. How many of you know the names of your great-great-grandparents? Maybe 5 or 6 people total knew the names of 1 or 2 great-great-grandparents. So my conclusion is that unless you're a very unusual person like Alexander the Great or, you know, some big historical personality, that by the time your grandchildren have grandchildren, your name is forgotten. And very, very few people with whom we interact really care deeply about our lives. So that's Gyan Yoga, is meditating on things like that. Meditating on how I'm not this body. I really have nothing to do with this world. That I'm just a soul. So in order to do that, in order to sit around and think about those things, and not just say, okay, enough philosophizing, let's go get a pizza. I mean, I remember that happening to me in college. When I was first getting interested in Krishna consciousness, I'd sit around with my friends and I'd talk about philosophy. And they'd say, yeah, yeah, okay, now let's go buy pizza. Huh?
Let's philosophize over a pizza.
Let's philosophize over a pizza. But, you know, unless you're qualified, you can't spend all day and all night every day doing that. So how are you going to get qualified? You have to have the peace that comes from renunciation, that comes from karma yoga. Or you have to at least have the peace that comes from pious activities. Generally, you go karma yoga to Gyan yoga, though you can go directly from karmakanda to Gyan yoga. But you can't just take the average person and say, perform karma yoga or perform Gyan yoga. They can't do it. Then above that is Gyan yoga. So a lot of what's being taught in the world today as yoga is Gyan yoga. Sometimes called Raja Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga, where you put your body in a position that automatically puts you in a trance and you breathe in a certain way. There are mechanical ways to put your body into a trance. Prabhupada talked about that with Stalin, that Stalin was able to put his mind into a trance so he could have surgery without anesthesia. And I could easily, in 10 or 15 minutes, put all of you into a trance and teach you how to put yourself into a mechanical trance. It's not hard. So, but the process of Ashtanga Yoga is like that. By putting your body in a certain posture and breathing in a certain way, and your body automatically goes into a trance. And of course, you also have to have pious life. That's the yama niyama. You can't just do anything. And then you gradually go to a mechanical samadhi.
What's a trance?
You experience a natural trance every day right before you go to sleep and right when you wake up. You're in a natural trance state. If you're ever foolish enough to watch television, you'll go into a natural trance state. If you listen to a really good storyteller, you'll go into a natural trance state. So you all know what it feels like. We all have at least two times a day we go into a natural mild trance. It's separate from waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, dreaming, and wakefulness. It's called Turiya, the fourth state of consciousness. So they would put they go into Dhyan Yoga, they put themselves in a trance, not sleeping. If you're sleeping, wake up, please. And then they meditate on Paramatma, they meditate on Vishnu. But they do this mechanically. They mess with the mechanics of the body and mind have a mechanical way to go into a trance. It's done basically by force of will. Now, to do that, you have to be very qualified. Anybody can go into a trance for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. But to live in a trance, to live in, you know, off in the mountains and not talk to anybody and not eat practically anything and live in a state of trance for years and years and years and years and years and years and years, you have to be highly qualified. So in order to do that, you have to have gone through either karma yoga or Gyan yoga. Generally, you go karma yoga, Gyan yoga, Gyan yoga, but you can't, because Krishna says the results of Gyan yoga and karma yoga are the same. We can make some argument that you could go immediately from karma yoga to Gyan yoga. Gyan yoga will either give you mystic powers, or you can go and be with the Paramatma. Now, our process of samadhi is different. Our process of samadhi is a samadhi of love. We're not really interested in mechanical samadhi. I mean, if you already know how to do mechanical samadhi, like that Brahmin we read about who was meditating on seva, on service, if you already naturally are adept at mechanical samadhi, then you can use that in Krishna's service. Maharaj Prithu did that, etc. But if you're not, please don't bother learning it. It's really a waste of time. If you're already good at it, you don't need to throw away what you're already good at. But but you don't need to learn that if you don't already know how to do it. Our samadhi is a samadhi of love. I think most of us here have loved somebody in our life.
Yes.
And what happens when you love somebody? You're absorbed in thinking about them. Or if you hate somebody, you're afraid of somebody. Ever been afraid of somebody and then you become absorbed in thinking of them that way? So we all experienced, Prabhupada gave a talk in Indian Sanat on Mayashakram and Aparta. Always think of Krishna with attachment, mind attached to Krishna. And he said, everyone knows what is attachment. Everyone knows what is a Shakti. We've all been attached to something that we can't get out of our mind even if we try, right? Yes? Yes? That's the kind of samadhi you want to have for Krishna. So in Krishna consciousness, Varnashram is optional as subsidiary devotional practices. That you can do the activities of Varnashram as something you offer to Krishna as secondary practices, but it's not required for purification, and none of the activities of Varnashram are angas of bhakti. Now, we did say there are some activities in Varnashram which are the same as angas of bhakti, but Varnashram in and of itself is not an anga of bhakti. And tomorrow we will look at two other things that people may think are angas of bhakti and are not, and that's knowledge and attachment. So, see if I've neglected to do anything today. Ah, yes, one other thing I'm going to do. On page 111, another little summary thing about the angas of bhakti. This would be the second or third paragraph, depending on how you want to count. In these statements about devotional service, sometimes it may appear that the results have been overestimated, but actually there is no overestimation. Some devotees, as revealed scriptures, give evidence have had immediate results by such association, although this is not possible for all. And going down a little. So these statements are not overestimation, nor are they stories. They are actual facts, but are true for certain devotees and do not necessarily apply to all. These descriptions, even if considered overestimations, must be taken as they are, in order to divert our attention from the fleeting material beauty to the eternal beauty of Krishna consciousness. And for a person who is already in contact with Krishna consciousness, the described results are not unusual. So when Rupa Goswami is saying, just by doing this, if you just follow the procession, if you just do this, if you just do this, if you just, you may say, oh yeah, I followed the procession, and that didn't happen to me. So Prabhupada is saying that these things have that potency. It's not that necessarily anyone who does them will get that immediate effect, but it is possible. And they're not just stories. Okay, let's go to our questions. And is that took care of? I want to take these first. What I like about the written questions is even people who don't raise their hand, I get to answer their questions. What is the best way to work out who is an advanced devotee of the Lord? And it states in Nectar Ocean, which we're very eager for their association. That's really a question for which shastra? What is the best way to work out who is an advanced devotee of the Lord? By the Gita Nectar of Instruction. So there's much more... there than an extra devotion. So where in Bhagavad Gita, you haven't studied Bhagavad Gita yet. So in Bhagavad Gita chapters 2, 12, and 14 is where you'll find the descriptions how you can ascertain who is an advanced devotee and also the nectar of instruction. We will get to a discussion of that on Friday, the symptoms of bhava. So in chapter 18, we'll discuss the 9 symptoms of bhava that you can ascertain objectively. Okay, this is a great question. This is just the kind of question I'm like, yes. We have seen so far that there are many contradictory statements from Prabhupada. How should we view this? Why has our Acharya made such errors? Are they errors? Do these contradictions make the Hare Krishna movement look bad to outsiders or new people? Why would Krishna allow this acharya to make such contradictory statements at the risk of losing some credibility? That's great. I remember Yamuna saying once that everything Srila Prabhupada said was perfect. And I thought, how would we explain that? And the way you would explain that is everything Prabhupada's, why just Prabhupada? Krishna makes contradictory statements. Krishna says to Arjuna that you should fight for honor, because for one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death. And then a little while later he says, don't fight for the sake of honor or dishonor. Which is it, Krishna? So everything's perfect in context. Knowledge always has a context. Knowledge is never without context. Knowledge isn't just some kind of knowledge floating in the sky. It's spoken by a person to a person in a situation. So I posted something on my Facebook wall where Prabhupada said that this is a very good nursery school. It's very good to have a nursery school because then the women can have some free time. He said the women are not just meant for looking after, I'm not getting the words exactly right. They're not just meant for looking after children, they're also meant for working in devotion. And so the one of my friends said, wait a minute, what about where Prabhupada said child worship is more important than deity worship? So I pulled the quote and it was a letter, and Prabhupada said, for you, child worship is more important than deity worship. Why? Because she was going to give away her 2-year-old child to somebody else so she could worship the deities. She was going to put her child up for adoption so she could worship the deities. And Prabhupada said, for you, child worship is more important than deity worship. So I remember a devotee in Bhagavatam class once quoting this letter from Srila Prabhupada to someone who'd stopped chanting their rounds. And Prabhupada said, chant at least an hour a day. So this is Prabhupada's instruction for people having problem. And I said, oh, maybe I didn't say it. I don't think I said. I think I just thought, you know, well, yeah. And 2 days, 3 days later, Prabhupada wrote another letter to another devotee who'd stopped chanting their rounds and said, move back in the temple, give up everything else, and chant 64 rounds a day. And I've written a separate letter to the temple president advising him of such. So those appear again to be opposite. You know, one person, Mahaprabhu, says, go get married. Another person says, don't get married. One person, you may say, stay with the deities, never leave the deities. Some other person, you say, get off the altar and go out and distribute books. One time, a Prabhupada said to a devotee, you're eating too much. The devotee said to Prabhupada, but when I came, you told me to eat a lot. And Prabhupada said, well, did you believe me then? So believe me now. So there may be opposite instructions given to different people or to the same person at different times. Prabhupada compares it to a medicine shop. So in a medicine shop, you know, different medicines are given to different patients at different times, and you have to have an expert physician. So all the instructions are there. Also in Bhagavad Gita, there's one purport in the 8th chapter where Prabhupada says you can fix your mind on any incarnation of Krishna. And the 18th chapter, Prabhupada said, only fix your mind on Krishna and do not divert your attention to any other incarnation. Now, I can't fix my mind on Lord Ramachandra if I don't divert my mind to Lord Ramachandra. It's not possible. You cannot follow both of those instructions. You just can't. One instruction says, fix your mind on Ramachandra, and the other says, don't even divert your attention to Lord Ramachandra. It's obviously in different moods, in different contexts, for different people. One instruction is for one person, one instruction is for another person. Do they make the movement look bad to outsiders? No, outsiders don't even notice such things. And in my experience. And to new people? No. I think it's just evidence that we're a personal movement, that we're dealing with a personal God, and that we deal with people personally. That, as I said, it's a principle that knowledge has to be applied to time, place, and circumstance. I think it would look bad if we always said exactly the same thing to everybody, because that's not reality. There are certain things that are absolutely true for everybody, like always remember Krishna and never forget. That's absolutely true for everybody, always. There's never a circumstance ever for anybody where that's not true. But most other things are contextual. Most other things are how do you apply principles in certain statements and in certain situations. And that's one of the requirements. One of Krishna's qualities is that he understands time, place, and circumstance that Rupa Goswami gives. And one of his qualities is that he knows how to, not only does he understand time, place, and circumstance, he knows how to apply knowledge to time, place, and circumstance. I just taught this class in Vrindavan to a different audience, And although I'm making, of course, many of the same points I made there, I'm also teaching the class somewhat differently because they wrote different questions. Well, it was a different group. And what you bring up in one place, you don't bring up in another. And what's true for you when you're 20 may not be true for you when you're 30. What may help your Krishna consciousness when you're in the Grihastha ashram will hurt your Krishna consciousness in the Vanaprastha ashram. Or just like my nephew, not in our tradition, but he was living as a brahmachari in his own religion. And at a certain point he told the guru in his own tradition, "I think I want to get married." So his teacher said, "Well, I can introduce you to a nice girl, but you have to look at her." Because as a brahmachari, he wasn't looking at any women. So sometimes we see this. Sometimes we see someone who's been a brahmachari for 10, 15, 20 years, and then when he gets married, he can't be into, he's not into getting married. Have you seen this or heard about this? You know, some guy gets married and he like can't look at his wife, talk to his wife, show her any affection, because it's like, he's still into being a brahmachari. So, you know, what's appropriate in one situation is not appropriate in another situation, and the instructions for how to advance are going to change. They're going to change from one person to another. They're going to change from one country to another. They're going to change from one time in your life to another. Nectar Devotion says that association with advanced devotees is transcendentally valuable. When dealing with non-devotees and speaking about Krishna, sometimes it's necessary to identify with the person so they hear your message. Definitely. Srila Prabhupada would sometimes just listen to people for 15 or 20 minutes before he would preach. You have to know something about that, where that person's coming from. First of all, you have to present Krishna consciousness appropriately according to time, place, and circumstance. So you have to know something about the person. I mean, if you want to be a good preacher, I mean, you don't have to, but if you want to be a good preacher, you need to tailor your presentation to the preachee. So you don't have to identify with that person, but you have to be able to have some empathy with them. At what point are we giving association rather than taking a non-devotee's association? The entire conversation might not be at all about Krishna. What I see this is that you can see how everybody's looking for Krishna. I think we talked about this before, didn't we? That ultimately everybody's looking for Satchitananda, and ultimately everybody's looking for Krishna. So I can empathize with anybody without taking their association. It's not difficult. Even if somebody's really in the mode of ignorance, you can understand, oh, this person's looking for Krishna. They're trying to enjoy the chivalrous ras or the ghastly ras, or, you know, they're looking for Krishna. They're looking for it in a chemical, or they're looking for it in an illicit relationship, or they're looking for it in something, but they're looking for Krishna. And I can celebrate that they're looking for Krishna, and I can try to help them to find what they're looking for with Krishna. I see taking others' association is when I'm trying to please them materially. When I am thinking that this person's going to be the one who's going to meet my needs, and in order to get my needs met, I have to please this person by following their standards. Always remember, it's Krishna who's paying your salary. And if you're dealing with non-devotees, what are they? Customers, suppliers, or co-workers? They're customers. Customers don't pay your salary. You know, we have to please the customers, but only to please the boss, not to please the customers independently. Okay, this one I already answered. Why are Ramayana and Mahabharata, etc., considered as scriptures in pursuance of the revealed scriptures? Because they're not, those scriptures are neither the four Vedas, nor are they like the Puranas, Itihasas, and Upanishads. This is discussed more in Ishopanishad. Have you already studied this in Ishopanishad?
Yeah.
The different parts of the Vedas and how they work together. Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that anything that inspires you to worship Krishna can be considered revealed scriptures. Did you notice that? I don't know if I can find that quote. But I find that quite... No. Let's talk about...
Anything material?
realize it. Oh, yeah, here it is, on page 101. Any book which gives enlightenment in the matter of advancing in devotional service is considered to be revealed scripture. Page 101. Isn't that interesting? Did you notice that too? I thought, wow, that's a very broad definition of revealed scripture. Any book which gives enlightenment in the matter of advancing in devotional service. Also, on the third paragraph on page 101, it says, a person who writes Vaishnava literature and keeps such literature at home has Lord Narayan always residing in his house. It was also fascinating. The holy name cannot be chanted offenselessly by one who has failed to purify his senses. Purification of the senses means that my senses are engaged in the service of the Lord. They're not engaged in sense gratification. As long as my senses are engaged selfishly, then I can't possibly, because then I'm materially motivated, I can't chant offenselessly. Offenselessly means I'm really chanting just to please Krishna. It's kind of like saying you can't be clean unless you're clean. It's almost a circular statement. And this is basically saying if you're still materially contaminated, there are going to be some offenses in your chanting. Of course, the chanting itself will relieve you of offenses. Okay, this is one of those ones that I don't know the answer to. One should not sit before the deity holding the ankles, elbows, or knees. Why is this an offense? I don't know. Remember I was saying when I talked about the offenses that some of them were intuitive and some of them you could see, oh yeah, I can understand why this might be an offense. And some of them it's just something Krishna doesn't like. And why exactly he doesn't like it, maybe he just thinks this is too casual a way to sit in front of him. I really don't know. But, you know, I know if somebody's trying to do something for me and they ask me what I like, they may not understand, and I've had this experience sometimes, when someone says to me, remember, what would you like, and I tell them, and they don't understand it, so they don't do it. Has that ever happened to you? And you said, well, I told you I didn't like it like this. And I said, but that was just stupid. But that's what I like. So, some of these things may just be like that. The Krishna just likes something. He's a person. That's what a person means, that there's certain things I like and certain things they don't like. Although maybe there's some other reason that I don't know. Okay, this is a little deep.
I've heard an answer to that.
Okay, fine. Yeah, sure.
I've been told that when you sit that way, that you're pointing your genitals towards the deities.
Could be. You know, again, I'd ask for what's your sadhu shastra reference, like one of those things about women shouldn't put their breasts on the ground, which is not in any shastra. And you've got all over the Bhagavatam, it says women should offer dandavats. And I can hug my mother, and she doesn't mind if my breasts touch her when I hug her. It's just sort of silly. So I wonder about that kind of thing. I mean, those sort of things always strike me as odd. All I can think of is it must not be a considered respectful way to be with a worshipable person. Again, I don't know. This is a deep one. Devotional service and friendship talks about developing confidence in the Lord and acting as his servant. Please explain, because I thought fraternity means serving Krishna as his friend. The so-called lower rasas are all contained in the so-called higher rasas. And I say so-called because whatever rasa you have is the highest for you. And in one sense, they're all equally pleasing to Krishna. But if you're a friend, you're also a servant. If you're a friend, you serve your friend. You're not a reverential servant, perhaps, but you are a servant. If you're a lover, you're also a servant. If you're a parent, you're a servant. So, service, feeling that I am doing service is included in all of the rasas. From the quote book, what does Prabhupada mean that we're not worshipping directly Radha Krishna but Lakshmi Narayan? Our mood is very reverential. Although we're worshipping deities of Radha Krishna, our process of worship is following the same process we'd be doing for worshipping Lakshmi Narayan. We're worshipping Radha Krishna, then you just go to Krishna and say, hey Krishna, I have something nice to eat. Would you like some? So we're not worshipping like that. That make sense?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see that. I think I've heard that, but I'm not sure. But what I have heard is that we're performing reverential processes of worship with the deities. So at least in all of our temples. Now, once you come to Raghunuga Bhakti, if you have your home deities, maybe you can worship them as Radha Krishna. But at least in our ISKCON temples, we're not going to have any general public worship like that. We're never going to institute a public deity worship standard of, hey, Krishna, try this samosa. It's good. I just had a bite of it. Would you like some? So, and we're not going to take the vegetables out of the samosas and put flowers inside and give it to Krishna and see him make a funny face. That's described in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So we're not going to do that. You know. So that's how you worship Radha Krishna. It is. But that's not what we're going to do in established public temples. If you're already on the platform of Raghunuga Bhakti, you know, maybe in your home worship you might do that in a fit of ecstasy. And don't write about it on the internet and tell everybody that you did that. That would be a private thing. If you're actually on that platform of ecstatic love. But that's not for general. Our general worship is reverential. One way to perform devotional service is to live in... Oh, we already did that. What is the crucial point for advancement in spiritual life? To always remember Krishna and never forget him. To love Krishna, to surrender to Krishna. Or maybe this person is asking, what's the crucial thing you should do for advancement in spiritual life? I think I answered earlier that there's more than one of them. That question can be answered variously. Oh, and I should say something on this. So you might meet somebody who did something that was their crucial point. And they had some sort of a real rocket ship experience in Krishna consciousness because of something they did. I've met two people now that had an experience like that by going on Vrajmandala Parikram, where they walk like, you know, 20, 30 kilometers a day and sleep in tents. Two different people who told me that doing that completely changed their whole spiritual life and like just... You know, they went very quickly up to a whole new platform. Or a person who enters, when you enter into Raghunuga Bhakti, which we'll talk about tomorrow. So one person may have their entering into Raghunuga Bhakti while they're reading the Bhagavatam, one while they're chanting in Kirtan, one while they're out distributing books. One senior devotee told me that his experience happened on an airplane flying over America. So if you think, oh, that devotee had a really far out experience. Just by bathing in the Ganga on the Purnima and Karti. So if I bathe in... But, you know, we're each individuals. Have you tried that? Somebody said, I had this, and you did it, and it was like... Did that happen? Oh, what happened to Narada Muni, you know, he did this meditation that his gurus taught him, and he saw the Lord, and then the Lord said, you're not going to see me again. He didn't believe it, and he did the same thing again, and it was nothing. It's not a mechanical process. We're dealing with a person. It's not a mechanical process. This is a process of developing love and a loving relationship. So we've been told what's the five most potent, right? Devotees, deities, dham, harinam, bhagavatam. That even a slight attachment for any one of these can arouse devotional ecstasy even in neophytes. So, okay, you've got those. And those have a lot of varieties under them, don't they? And we talked about, you know, devotees' foot bath water and foot dust and food remnants. But each of those, I mean, there's so many things in the Dham and so many aspects to Nam and so many aspects to Bhagavatam and so many aspects to serving the devotees and so many aspects to serving the deities. There's millions of different activities you could do in each of those categories. And even though those are the most potent, we read with the other 61 how just by following the elephant procession,
just by drinking a drop of Charanamrita. So you get to have a nice surprise and see what things are going to be for you. Which one is it going to be? You know, which thing, where will Krishna come today or tomorrow? And how he appears to you one day may be different than how he appears to you another day. You may chant all your rounds and just be Krishna. And then you put down your bead bag and you pick up the nectar devotion to read the class and you start crying in ecstasy. You say, why didn't I cry in ecstasy during my japa, Krishna? Who knows? Who knows? I don't know. Sometimes it's one sentence you hear in a class, isn't it? And your whole heart goes, whoop, whoop, whoop. And then you sit in class for another, or you think, oh, it was that speaker. And you follow that speaker all over the world. Never happens again. You're dealing with a person. You're dealing with Krishna. It's a person. Don't think it's a mechanical thing. Don't think if I just push the buttons this way and this way and this way. You know, it's not like that. And Krishna doesn't like that, by the way. If you deal with him mechanically, he runs away very fast. He just doesn't like it. Krishna's not, you know, it's not like a little phone. You push the buttons and you get a certain thing that happens. And why does it happen? Who knows? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Even in our normal jiva relationships, who can say? Why one day when you make lasagna, your husband's happy, and the next day you make lasagna, he's not happy? I don't know. Why one day if your husband gives you flowers, you're happy, the next day he gives you flowers, and you're not happy? I don't know. We're people. But I do know that we as people don't like to be dealt with mechanically. You know, we wouldn't like it if our husband said, wait a minute, I gave you flowers yesterday and you were happy. Why aren't you happy today? You're supposed to be. You know, we wouldn't like that. Or it says right here in the book that when I give you flowers, you're supposed to be happy. You know, it's not... That's not how it works. You know, I give people my email address, but it doesn't mean I have to answer them in 5 minutes. I think I gave this example before. You know, every once in a while I have people say, you know, sometimes they're actually nasty about it. How come you didn't answer my email? Maybe because I have 50 letters in my email and I have an extra devotion class to teach and a Bhagavatam class to teach. Maybe you're not the only person in the world. Maybe I know it's there. Maybe I'm meditating on it for a week. Because it's a long, complicated question. I love these questions, so we're going to have to... We don't have much time tomorrow. We'll see if we get... I'll just do a couple more. Is that all right? And then we'll stop. Is it still pure devotional service if you desire your life to have a worthwhile purpose and engage with Krishna from that place? Everything's fine as long as you're thinking, I'm going to get everything by pleasing Krishna. Really, I just want Krishna to be happy. When Krishna's happy, I'll get everything. But not, I want to please Krishna, so I'll get something. That you have something that I want. And I don't care about your pleasure, I just care about getting what I want. That's not pure devotional service. But if I think I can forget about what I want and just please you, and I know if I just please you, I'll naturally, automatically get what I want. That's pure devotional service. It's subtle, but it's very... The effect is very different. It's subtle, but the effect is very different. Does Krishna fulfill all of our spiritual and material needs all the time? He certainly wants to, and he's certainly available to. Whether or not we experience that depends on how much we're connected with any other. I can ask really quickly. What is meant by the term seva aparad, any offense in the process of worship? Is it offensive to offer obeisances to the guru in front of the deities? This is a really sticky question, and I've heard devotees debate it back and forth and upside down and inside out. And my answer is that different munis have different opinions on that one. How can an offender unto the Lord himself be delivered by? How can an offender to the Lord be delivered?
By chanting
the holy name. Okay, the rest of these we will get to tomorrow. And tomorrow we will look at the other two things that are not angas of bhakti, knowledge and detachment, that are not angas of vaidhi sadhana bhakti. And then we're going to move on to raganuga sadhana bhakti. And again, everyone, you need to be prepared with the 9 processes of devotional service. So we're not going to discuss. I'm just going to say, okay, you group are going to take hearing. You group are going to take remembering. Who's the person who did it? And come up and do a picture or a presentation or something. So you've got to come knowing that. Thank you, Haribo.
Thank you.